You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we speak to a Greek entrepreneur who tells us what the atmosphere is like in Athens as the country prepares to vote on Sunday for a new government that could also determine the future of the euro.
We feel that the storm may be coming and we are kind of positioning ourselves. It is in our hands to vote and decide the way forward.
We'll also meet the UN's special envoy to the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in Cambodia, David Scheffer, a man considered to be one of the fathers of modern war tribunals.
Consider all of the problems and weaknesses in the system and imperfections. Yes, you bet. You bet they're there. But guess what? 20 years ago, there wasn't anything at all.
And as it's almost the weekend, we meet one of Midori House's neighbours as part of this regular strand. Today, it's all about cocktails.
As well as pushing forward our own new techniques, we also celebrate very much the history of drinking and drinking culture.
In addition, we also check in with our Section E editor, Santiago Rodriguez Tediti, and I'll be playing a couple of songs too. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. Political parties in Greece are making their last efforts to attract votes ahead of a rerun election. The ballot is seen as crucial to the country's future in the eurozone. New Democracy, the pro-bailout Conservative Party, which narrowly led at the ballot last month, is due to hold its last big campaign rally. Syriza, the anti-bailout group, which achieved second place in May, held its final rally in Athens yesterday. Two polls in France have shown President François Hollande's socialists winning outright control of parliament in a weekend election there, as campaigning drew to an end on Friday. Such a result would offer Mr. Hollande the prospect of a free hand to confront the debt crisis in Europe. Portugal's finance minister, Vitor Gaspar, has said the eurozone needs to lay out its long-term vision, but also have measures that are more immediately effective in tackling the current crisis. He said he expected to see progress soon. Portugal has already said that painful austerity demanded by the terms of the EU-IMF bailout are paying off, but Mr. Gaspar said more needed to be done.
We are all together fully committed to find a solution that will actually work. That solution will necessarily involve a long-term vision, exactly as Mario was emphasizing, but also some policy actions that may be effective in the short run.
Egyptian liberals and Islamists are reported to be making ready for mass protests against the dissolution of the parliament elected after last year's overthrow of veteran general Hosni Mubarak. Some commentators have drawn parallels with the start of the Algerian civil war 20 years ago, when generals scrapped an election that Islamists appeared to be winning. The daughter of jailed Ukrainian opposition politician Yulia Tymoshenko has urged the international community to put much more pressure on the government of President Viktor Yanukovych as the controversial Euro 2012 football tournament gets underway in the country. Mrs. Tymoshenko was sentenced to 7 years in prison last October on abuse of office charges. The European Union saw her case as an example of selective justice and has shelved an association agreement with Kiev over the issue. Speaking at a news conference in Paris, her daughter Eugenia said the football tournament's success would be thanks to work done when her mother was prime minister, much of which had been ruined by the new government.
In the last 3 years, this opportunity has been spoiled. Ukraine became isolated and Ukrainian nation lost because of the action of the regime and because of political repressions and just rollback of democracy in all levels.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said his country is not discussing plans for a Syrian political transformation should President Bashar al-Assad leave power. Mr. Lavrov emphasized Moscow's strong opposition to external interference. And Yemen's army claims it's recaptured the last al-Qaeda stronghold in Abyan province. Officials now say victory is close for their offensive to drive Islamist militants from towns they seized more than a year ago. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, James. It's 18:05 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Greece is preparing to return to the voting booths on Sunday as it once again tries to elect a new government. For Greeks, it's a choice between parties that will continue the austerity drive but fight to remain in the eurozone, and parties that say they will tear up the old budgets as they try to spend more money, but with the risk that Greece may be forced to go back to the drachma. To find out how Greeks feel about what's coming up, I spoke earlier to Athens-based entrepreneur Yanis Sarkonis, who has been a regular voice on Monocle 24 over the past crisis-hit months. I started by asking what the mood is currently like in Athens.
I think the mood changes by the day. And I think the last couple of days, the mood is kind of numb. After going through a very short and striking post-election and pre-election period the last month, I think people are more clear with the parties' positions and people and faces. And there's a certain level of frustration still because it's not clear who is going to take us out of this crisis. So there is a certain kind of, we feel that the storm may be coming and we are kind of positioning ourselves. It is in our hands to vote and kind of decide the way forward.
Now, among the people that you know and that you've been speaking to, are people sticking to the parties they voted for last time, or do you detect any kind of shift in the way people are feeling?
I think there's a lot of shifting around. Exactly, because it's difficult to identify with anyone in particular. It's kind of a process of elimination, the least harmful. There was a lot of reactive vote in the previous elections, and now the last month we have learned more about everybody and everything, more or less. So people now are making a decision which is based more, a more educated decision, meaning that the options that we have to vote are clearly the ones that we feel will take us out of this mess.
Now, we've been covering on Monocle 24 the kind of movement of Greek people. We've covered stories about Greek people moving to Sweden, to Australia. Again, amongst the people that you know in the business community, are you finding that people are thinking perhaps this is the time to leave Greece and try and set up companies elsewhere in Europe, or to even go further to Australia, etc.?
Among the people I know, yes, first of all, you don't have people really returning after the studies or the first stints of work as they used to. There is such a mode. And then you have people like ship owners that are considering to move to Singapore or outside. You have professionals who cannot find work and they would go back to Switzerland or Sweden or London and find work. You have, there is a movement around, definitely, yeah.
Now, the other thing that's been much debated is the amount of money that's being taken out of banks as euros, in the fear that if the drachma comes back, the currency could collapse and that people will be seeing their kind of savings evaporate. Can I ask you personally, has that been a pressure for you? Have you decided to take money out of the bank?
No, in that sense. I mean, I have always been keeping money that I run for my business. But I'm in the category that has not been trusting the Greek banks in terms of money management, etc., for quite a while.
Now, again, do you think that Greek people at this time feel that Europe is with them or against them? I wonder when Greek people look to the headlines that are appearing in newspapers in France, in Germany, do people in Greece feel that, in fact, they've been slightly abandoned?
I don't think they feel that they're abandoned. I think that there is, first of all, it seems that the last month there is a change of mood also in Europe. Let's say a year ago we felt that we were the only bad people or the only bad country. It is now it's clear that there is a European level issue from a different point of view. You know, Spain has different problems than what we have. But in terms of like feeling towards the Europeans, I think there is some people feel that the Germans and specifically Merkel has been too strict and not very constructive. Whereas now there is a feeling that maybe these people were right, and with Hollande's election and Monti's position, you know, there's a certain, let's say, movement now that is becoming more apparent towards the direction that we need to adjust some things at the European level, not such a strict austerity, without not following such a strict austerity program without an outlook for growth. And I think we are somewhere in between, because it is clear that we need to clean up the mess in terms of like mismanagement of funds, corruption, etc., and productivity and productive industries. But at the same time, there is a large mess at the level of European regulations, finance, macro level.
And just tell me, the idea that the drachma could come back perhaps in the next few months if the election brings back to power parties opposed to going along with Merkel's plans and with the European plans for austerity. Do some Greek people actually look forward now to potentially a return of the drachma?
I think there may be some people who, wrongly so, have a feeling that by going to the drachma, you know, we will not be having to report to anybody, we'll have our own currency. And there are certain people who already have taken their money out on the side, and they would be very happy, and some of them even have some very big loans. So they may be very happy that these loans go to half, and that the money that they have outside may be buying twice as much as they would buy now. Unfortunately, there are some such people around, yeah.
And finally, can I just ask you, it's often strange at this time of year when, you know, Greece is bathed in amazing weather, people are eating out at the cafes, you know, life goes on to the streets. Is there a kind of sense of that being stalled this year? Do you notice again amongst your friends that people aren't going to the islands at the weekend, they're staying in Athens? Is there a kind of change in mood while this storm is going on?
I think the last month there has been a change in mood, yes. There is this whole uncertainty. It's a frustrating situation. And even the people who have the money, many people don't have the money to go to spend in the islands. And the people who have the money, they feel that they should not be showing off, that they should not be letting other people feel bad about them spending money or going out on the boat, etc. So people have been very subtle and tame with their public behavior, let's say.
Well, Yasin, it's been amazing over these last few weeks to return to you again and again to kind of get your take on what's happening in Athens as an entrepreneur and as somebody who continues to do business there. And we look forward to speaking to you again after the elections. Thank you.
I hope when we speak again, we'll be still in the euro and have found a solution.
That was Yason Sarkonis talking with me earlier. Now, do you check your emails as soon as you wake up? How much time have you spent this week in your supposedly free evenings answering work phone calls or even replying to even more emails from work? Well, in Germany, this could become illegal if one government minister gets what she wants. More about that after this short break.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
This weekend will bring you all the fun of the fair here on Monocle 24. If you can't make it down to the inaugural Monocle Country Fair at Midori House on Saturday and Sunday, fear not, as we'll be covering it right here throughout the weekend. We'll bring you live music from our bands and DJs, reports from Monochan, our new Monocle mascot, breaking news from the Tombola, and the latest happenings in the Monocle Petting Zoo. So, if you're missing out on the goings-on at Midori House, you can always hear what's happening at the Monocle Country Fair right here on Monocle 24. For more information, head to monocle.com/countryfair, and that's fair with a Y, of course.
The German Labour Minister, Ursula von der Leyen, has big plans. She wants very clear rules regarding when an employee should be reachable by email and work phone and when companies must leave their staff in peace. If she gets what she wants, companies could be fined up to €25,000 for making staff read work emails during free time out of the office. How realistic is this, and what could this kind of legislation do to a country's competitiveness? I'm joined by Professor Steve Jeffries, Director of the Working Lives Institute at the London Metropolitan University. Hello, Professor. So, first of all, do you think it's conceivable that you could legislate for this? It seems a very complicated piece of legislation to stop people looking at their phones or their BlackBerries out of office hours.
Well, it's basically about working time. How long you actually spend at work and how long you spend working. And there is legislation out there at the moment which says that there should be 35 hours in most countries, 40 hours in some. In the UK, we've got a dispensation to allow people to work up to 48 hours. But the issue really is, how can that be timed? Well, actually, all the electronic connectivity we have in relationship to work is timed. You know, you click onto an email, there is a mechanism for actually sort of tracking that. You deal with a BlackBerry phone call, there's a way of tracking that. So it is possible to see whether or not you are actually working more than the number of hours that you should do.
Now, we have some statistics here from Germany. It says that 84% of Germans are reachable by their clients or their boss outside of work hours, and 51% said they were accessible around the clock. Is that a particularly German thing, or do you think that's just culturally now throughout the kind of the Western world that there is this expectation that you will be reachable by your boss and by your clients?
Yeah, the figures don't say who was sampled, but clearly some people in some jobs are experiencing that kind of lives. I mean, it's certainly true in my job and probably most other white-collar jobs that have got kind of managerial or professional content. It's not the same necessarily with clerical work. It's not the same at all with manual work. So it depends a lot on what kind of job that we're actually talking about. But yeah, it is what's happening. And one of the reasons for the Working Time Directive, which is now really quite old, is that the longer you work, the more stress you can be under. And if your home life is being invaded by emails and telephone calls all the time, then basically what is there left? Where is that moment that you can relax? Where is that moment that you can take your eye off that ball that is work and devote it to yourself, your family, your own health?
Now, do you think in the UK then, if, for example, we'll start close to home, if an employee said that, OK, I don't want to look at any work emails after I've left the office, I don't want to accept phone calls, would they be in a strong position legally to say that?
They would certainly be in a strong position legally, but whether or not the law would then defend them is something else. I mean, the company Volkswagen in Germany, around about Christmas time, decided that they would have a bar on producing any email, work email traffic, half an hour after the allotted kind of scheduled time. So I think between 6:30 and 6:30 a.m. and 6:30 p.m., it's permissible to email and to telephone colleagues. After that time, it isn't. And the issue there is it's about the question of how you can regulate the ways in which new technologies are, meaning that the dividing line between work and home is virtually not there anymore.
Now, do you think that for productivity, that in fact, you know, Germany is a very successful country at the moment, the most successful economy probably in Europe. Do you think this hampers or helps a country's economy if you put in these restrictions and you make sure that people work really to the hours that they're kind of contracted for?
Yeah, well, most of the evidence does suggest that the more you focus on saying, OK, I've got somebody at work for 35 hours, I'm really going to try and get their work organised in such a way that they work most effectively during that time. That does actually aid productivity. I mean, in Britain's productivity is lower than French, lower than German, lower than Danish. I mean, our productivity rates are in part low because of the very long hours that people in the UK are expected to work.
And do you see big differences from country to country in how this kind of accessibility works and actually how it's managed?
Yeah, well, there are very big differences. I mean, there is a question of cultures, and national cultures are different. Expectations, for example, that you have a rigid kind of working regime, that you all go to work at 8 o'clock or 8:30, and you all go home at 4:35. That sort of idea is much stronger within France and Germany, for example, and Sweden than it is in, for example, in the UK. Culturally, there have been sort of differences between the ways in which people live their lives. Those countries like the UK that have had higher female participation in the workforce have had much more flexible kind of working hours, because that means that both men and women have shared more than, for example, was the case in for most workers in Germany. But these things are, with new technologies and with changes over the last 5, 10, 20 years, these things have become more similar across Europe. So some of the problems are very similar.
And do you think those problems are much more striking now? I remember many years ago when answer phones first came in, and you'd be away for work and there was a way of phoning in and checking your messages. In fact, it was cumbersome and more stressful, I think, actually, than looking at the BlackBerry in your pocket these days. But do you think we've always had to kind of strike for that kind of work-life balance? Or do you think it is a really just the amount of new technology that we face every day now that is actually the most extreme the problem has ever been?
It is more extreme now. I mean, there is a real sense in which all of us who work, and most of us who work in desk jobs, are working in front of a computer. And that does mean that you're getting emails. That does mean that you're accessing globally a whole range of different sort of people and information sources all the time. Now, logically, there's no reason why that doesn't continue at home as well. So the question is, how do you draw the line? And that's really about the nature of what society wants. And if we want to have a society in which people do have leisure, in which they have full leisure time, in which they do have families, where they are adjusted to the ways in which they're working, and they can back out of the stressful situation, then there does need to be some initiative like the one being proposed here in Germany. Although I'm frankly a little sceptical about its origins. It is a Christian Democratic party that's in power. They have a tradition of being very concerned about employee welfare, but usually they are not very, very concerned about challenging employer prerogatives. And in this particular case, it could well be that the employers decide, well, we don't really want to play ball with this, because this is protection of workers from, if you like, super exploitation. So I'd be very interested in seeing whether this idea is a kite that has been floated, whether it's about trying to win the elections that will be coming up next year, or whether it is a real attempt to try and improve workers' health.
And tell me, you're implying then, which is interesting, that actually if you did bring in a piece of legislation like this, and on the face of it, it seems a little bit crazy when you first look at it, but when you start talking about it, do you think that it would actually, you'd see savings for healthcare, savings for divorce rates, saving for kids ending up in care, if it really did kind of protect family life of an evening?
Well, I think family life is being threatened by the new technologies. I mean, certainly my own wife, my own grandchildren would probably say exactly that. And if we moved closer to a sort of an idea that we were counting our working time, and this is the problem with the new technology, you very often don't count. You count when you go into work, but when that telephone rings or when you get that email late at night, you don't count it in the same way. Now, if the legislation or the proposed regulation were to include that within working time, then there would be a real renegotiation of what is work and what is paid for work. And that's really quite, I think, important in the longer term, because otherwise we are likely all to be working 50, 60, 70-hour weeks, and that is certainly not going to be good for anyone.
Well, I got you to turn off your phone when you came into the studio, so it's a test for you, whether you turn it back on again when you leave here or whether you leave it turned off for the evening. Professor Steve Jeffries, thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House, and we're going to continue with some music. This is the Pet Shop Boys with What Have I Done to Deserve This? We'll be right back. That was the Pet Shop Boys with What Have I Done to Deserve This?
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Du lytter till Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, no chicanes.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be checking in with our Section E editor, Santiago Rodriguez Taditi. We'll meet the father of modern war crimes tribunals, and we drop in one of Midori House's neighbours. But first, here's the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Political parties in Greece are making their last efforts to attract votes ahead of a rerun election. The ballot is seen as crucial to the country's future in the Eurozone. New Democracy, the pro-bailout Conservative Party, which narrowly led at the ballot last month, is due to hold its last big campaign rally. Syriza, the anti-bailout group, which achieved second place in May, held its final rally in Athens yesterday. Two polls in France have shown President François Hollande's socialists winning outright control of Parliament in a weekend election, as campaigning drew to an end on Friday. Such a result would offer Mr. Hollande the prospect of a free hand to confront the debt crisis in Europe. Portugal's finance minister, Vítor Gaspar, has said the Eurozone needs to lay out its long-term vision, but also have measures that are more immediately effective in tackling the current crisis. He said he expected to see progress soon. Egyptian liberals and Islamists are reported to be making ready for mass protests against the dissolution of the parliament elected after last year's overthrow of veteran general Hosni Mubarak. Some commentators have drawn parallels with the start of the Algerian civil war 20 years ago, when generals scrapped an election that Islamists appeared to be winning. The daughter of jailed Ukrainian opposition politician Yulia Tymoshenko has urged the international community to put more pressure on the government of President Viktor Yanukovych as the controversial Euro 2012 football tournament gets underway in the country. Speaking at a news conference in Paris, Eugenia Tymoshenko said the football tournament's success would be thanks to work done when her mother was prime minister, much of which had been ruined by the new government. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said his country is not discussing plans for a Syrian political transformation should President Bashar al-Assad leave power. Mr. Lavrov emphasized Moscow's strong opposition to external interference. And Yemen's army claims it has recaptured the last al-Qaeda stronghold in Abyan province. Officials now say victory is close for their offensive to drive Islamist militants from towns they seized more than a year ago. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, James. You're listening to Midori House, where every weekday at this time we speak to one of Monocle's editors about something exciting that's going on in their area of expertise. Today, it's the turn of our Section E editor, Santiago Rodriguez Taditi, who happens to be in Sao Paulo right now. Santiago, thank you for joining us. What are you doing in Sao Paulo, and where have we actually tracked you down to?
Hi, Andrew. How are you? I've been here in Sao Paulo for 2 days now. It's a great city to walk. It's actually much better to see the city on foot than on a car because of course traffic jams are all over the place. Right now I'm in the hotel, but I will soon go to Mani. One of the most talked about restaurants here in Sao Paulo these days. This restaurant reached the number 51, position number 51 in the list of the 100 best restaurants in the world. It is run by Helena Rizzo, who used to be a famous model here in Brazil, and her husband, Daniel Redondo. And they cook very interesting food. Apparently, I can tell you later about that. But they use a lot of local produce, and they cook a lot of Amazonian ingredients and traditional recipes from the area as well.
So it's interesting, Santiago. You're obviously Colombian, and I believe this is your first time in Brazil. Is that correct?
It is my first time in Brazil, and I'm actually half Brazilian.
Okay.
Because, my mother's side of family is from Minas Gerais.
Okay, so you're in trouble then with your family for not going before. But what's interesting, obviously this is what we always talk to you about food and drink and hospitality, but on the food and drink side, I was in Mexico recently, and the same thing there. People were cooking with very traditional ingredients. There was a kind of reinvention of Mexican food, a pride in the cuisine. You've talked to us about something similar happening in Colombia. Do you think this is something throughout Latin America, as these economies become stronger, people are a bit more kind of proud of their traditions and their heritage and playing around with them, even in top-notch restaurants?
Yes, definitely. I think pride is the word that we should use here, because for many years the region was a developing region. We were known as third world countries and so on. And now we've proved the world that the region and the particular countries within the region can grow at incredible rates, far better than the rest of the world, far better than Europe. So instead of applying what we learned from Europe in the past, we now want to show the world what we're made of. So definitely in the culinary scene, we're very, very proud of our ingredients. As you said, Mexico is cooking a lot of insects. Colombia is also exporting edible ants. And what I see here in Brazil is that they're starting to cook a lot with exotic fruits, fruits that can only be found here or in the Amazonian region. For example, Alex Atala's restaurant, DOM, that made it to the fourth position this year in the 50 Best Restaurant Awards, has some dishes that you will only find here in Brazil, and that's what makes it so special.
Now, when I speak to Brazilians who have moved to London and they talk about going home to Brazil, the one thing they all complain about now is that, in fact, it's incredibly expensive, that the reais has done so well as a currency that it's really tough for them going back home. Are you finding that, as an outsider, that prices do seem very high in restaurants, in hotels?
Yes, definitely. The prices are excessive. Everything is just ridiculously expensive. It's just as expensive as London or other big cities in Europe, if not more expensive. I've seen all the shops on the streets, and a random pair of jeans, no brand in particular, it can be $100 or £80, and no particular brand, as I said. Food also, any night out to grab a quick meal is going to cost you at least £40 per person.
Well, I wouldn't invest in any jeans at the moment, Santiago, because I've got a feeling you won't know what size you are until you get back. It sounds to me as though you might be putting on a few sizes if you have too many more of these nice meals. Now, just tell me, you were in Rio. Obviously, they have the Rio 20 summit coming up. Did it feel like a city preparing for a big event? Were you aware of additional security?
Definitely, I could see that. As you mentioned, it's one of the biggest events that the city has hosted recently, and I think it's an experiment to see how the city will cope with the World Cup and the Olympic Games that are soon to come as well. You could see soldiers patrolling the streets, especially in front of the big international hotel chains. And a lot of cops as well, but again, it's a city that feels very, very safe. People are always smiling, running along the beach, and you could see there was a big influx of foreigners who were wearing heavy clothes because they thought they were going to encounter a cold Rio de Janeiro due to the winter, but. Truth is, it doesn't get cold around here.
Now, I understand later today you're going to go and meet Issei Weinfeld, who is an amazing architect based in Sao Paulo and who has been responsible for all the Fasano hotels. Are you just going to go and check, see what else he has on the drawing board?
Yes. I want to see what his upcoming projects are. And he has a new office in an area known as Villa Maddalena here, which is what I hear is that it is an up-and-coming area where a lot of designers and artists and the young creatives are moving to. And it's also a good spot to grab a drink. So I might stay. I might try and convince him to grab a drink with me after the meeting.
Well, and just finally, it's interesting. I'm not sure where you've been staying in both cities, but it always surprises me when you're there how few good brands of hotels there are. In Rio, there seems to be half a dozen kind of hotels that everyone recommends again and again. Do you see any inklings of new developments coming up? Have you heard about new projects, or is it? Do you feel it still is a bit locked down in the opportunities?
I think that the opportunities are for small boutique hotels, because there are some of the big chains. You will see Marriott and Mercure and whatnot, but it's the smaller hotels that are going to be really, really attractive and are going to make a difference in the market. For example, in Rio, there's the Hotel Santa Teresa, which is a very, very beautiful hotel in the Santa Teresa neighborhood, which is I thought it was the most real Rio de Janeiro. That's what I was expecting to find, a Rio de Janeiro with cobbled streets, with small colorful houses, with a tram through the streets as well. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for that. The Fasano has a lot of other hotels opening in the next 5 years in both Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo, and in other cities like Troncoso and elsewhere in the country. So I think there's definitely a market for a smaller scale of boutique hotels, family run, with great service, and less of those big corporate hotels where you're going to be bumping into the angry businessman at the lobby.
I never like bumping into him. He's not my friend. Although I must say that I did read about that hotel in Santa Teresa, because that tram, it did come off the tracks about 2 years ago, and I think killed quite a few people. But anyway, as long as it's running again nicely for you, I'm very happy. Now, Santiago, enjoy the rest of your stay, and thank you very much for joining us. And I'd encourage listeners to look forward to the quality of life issue, which is about to hit newsstands next week, because Santiago has done an amazing story about sport cities around the world, cities which naturally kind of make you want to kind of get fit and be fit. And he did do a great piece on Rio de Janeiro. There's a good story about running in Rio, and that's in the next issue, which is the July-August quality of life issue, which will be on newsstands next week. Anyway, we're going to be changing tack now, and we're going to talk with David Sheffer, who's considered to be one of the fathers of modern war crimes tribunals, just after this break.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture, from the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
They say money makes the world go round, and all next week on Monocle 24, we'll be taking a closer look at the notes and coins in your pockets. From the ubiquitous dollar to the creaking euro, and taking in a few more extreme examples along the way. So tune in for the currencies every day next week on The Globalist and The Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24.
David Sheffer was one of the key movers behind the modern revival of the war crimes tribunals, with special courts for crimes committed from Rwanda to Yugoslavia. He's also one of the fathers of the International Criminal Court. Now he's the UN Special Envoy to the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in Cambodia, and his latest visit there coincides with the local launch of his memoir about his work in international criminal justice. All the Missing Souls recounts David Sheffer's struggles to convince leaders both in the US and abroad of the value of international justice. He's been talking to our correspondent in Phnom Penh, Guy Delaunay, and he told him that it all started with the optimism of the so-called New World Order in the early 1990s.
At the end of the Cold War, suddenly we could turn to Russia and China and ask them and negotiate with them for initiatives in the Security Council that we were not in any position to do prior to 1990. And one of those initiatives was accountability, because there were new enlightened governments, certainly in Russia, and China was, you know, coming out of the shadows economically and was willing to consider either voting for or abstaining on initiatives of this character.
I think I'm right in saying that you were in at the start of all the international criminal tribunals that we've seen set up, whether that's Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Cambodia, and also the International Criminal Court. You were involved.
And that is what the book is all about, are those five courts. So it's really a story about how did five courts get built? How were they negotiated? How were they different from each other? What were the politics? Who were the diplomats? Who were the people creating obstacles to it? And the risks involved, the costs involved.
It sounds like you had some high ideals about what these institutions could achieve. How do you think it's panned out?
I think relatively successful. Who would have imagined 20 years ago that we would have a web of international legal institutions around the world in various places that were bringing leaders, including heads of state, to justice? Charles Taylor was just convicted for 50 years for his aiding and abetting in the war in Sierra Leone as the head of state of Liberia. So I think an enormous transformation has taken place in international criminal justice. Of course, when one says that, you can always sit back and say, but consider all of the problems and weaknesses in the system and imperfections. Yes, you bet. You bet they're there. But guess what? 20 years ago, there wasn't anything at all.
One of the interesting things which occurred to me is who's going on trial at these places. Yep. And there was a line in one of the reviews for your book, I believe it was in the Financial Times, more or less saying, can these institutions ever apply justice to anybody except the losers? Yeah. And how do you feel about that?
I feel it's a very valid point. There is a question of equality and of reciprocity in the law. And I think the major powers, some of them have signed up and ratified and joined the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, such as France and the United Kingdom and Germany and other major European states, Canada, Japan, they're all there. The United States, Russia and China and India and Indonesia are not there. And I think ultimately that creates a kind of a disconnect in the international criminal justice system. I have argued for a long time, having signed the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court on behalf of the United States, but we're in a situation where we have not ratified the treaty yet, that the time has arrived really for the United States to stop being so intimidated by the prospect of international justice. We should be so proud of our national justice system that we know, just like the Brits and the French have attested for their systems, you know, if something goes wrong, we know how to investigate and prosecute it here at home. And that's the premise of the Rome Statute, to defer to that national sense of confidence in accounting for your own. I think the longer the years transpire with the United States out of the system, the longer becomes the impression that, frankly, we cannot get it done domestically, and therefore we're afraid of joining an international institution that looks to us to get the job done domestically. I think that's the great weakness of the last administration, the George W. Bush administration, and that so many actions were taken which then raised the question, well, what about holding your own leaders accountable for those actions? And there were clear efforts to immunize American leaders from the whole saga of torture and detainee abuse during the so-called War on Terror. That's a big problem for the United States, and I would like to see us overcome it with confidence, with extreme confidence.
And does it mean that military leaders are going to be helping to provide the evidence to prosecutors, because this is a big problem that you had with Yugoslavia, was that they weren't helping you on the ground to get the evidence that you needed to prosecute people.
I mean, ultimately that was developed, but yes, in the early stages it was a learning curve of enormous dimension to kind of get the system turned on for proper evidence collection. I think it's different now. I mean, even on Syria, I noticed that the United States apparently has been very active in collecting evidence on the atrocities in Syria, with the anticipation that that evidence could ultimately be very, very useful in prosecutions. So there's kind of an automatic switch now that does come on, whereas during the 1990s, believe me, there was nothing. We were on manual drive. We did not have automatic drive in the vehicle of justice in the 1990s. It was purely a manual stick drive.
Do you think that if the U.S. were to sign on to the Rome Statute, that Russia, China, India, Indonesia, I mean, these are the five biggest countries in the world, actually, come to think of it, aren't they? Yeah. And do you think they would sign on too?
Clearly, I think if the United States were to move forward, it would put a much more pressure on Russia and China, just on under the general umbrella of rule of law. Where do you stand? Well, the United States now stands clearly for rule of law because they've totally signed on, and that puts pressure. Frankly, I think the country that might be the best prospect for joining, particularly if the United States were to ratify, would be Indonesia, because there have already been many efforts to ratify the Rome Statute in Indonesia. So there's kind of a system that just needs further pressure to really activate the ratification in Indonesia. That's really the best prospect. And it's a hugely populous country, as everyone knows. So it would be very important.
And of course, with what's happening in Syria ongoing, if you want these prosecutions to go ahead, it could make all the difference to have those extra countries on side.
Absolutely. For example, when the Arab League speaks on an issue like Syria, to be able to turn to the most populous Muslim country in the world, which is Indonesia, and say you're on board with this point, that can make a huge impact. Absolutely huge.
All the Missing Souls is, at the end of the day, it's a memoir of what you were involved with for the best part of a decade. If you could go back to that process with hindsight, what would you change?
The hindsight analysis can always be undertaken, but I hope what my book demonstrates is that as I tried to negotiate the shalls of politics both at home and abroad, it's sometimes kind of a hit and miss enterprise where you don't know what it's going to look like a week from now. You're just trying to deal with it as it confronts you that day. But one thing that I would have done, I think, far better is the relationship with the U.S. Congress and building up support within those sectors of Congress which are more understanding and appreciative of international justice initiatives, as opposed to letting a very conservative faction of Congress have such a deep influence on the process.
That was the UN Special Envoy to the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in Cambodia, David Sheffer, speaking to Monocle's Guy Delaunay. It's 1852 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck, and this is The Cardigans with My Favourite Game. That was My Favourite Game by The Cardigans from their 1998 album Gran Turismo. The Cardigans are reuniting for a special appearance at the Hultsfred Music Festival this evening in Sweden. The Hultsfred Festival is Sweden's annual summer rock festival, and it takes place around Lake Hulingen. There you go. Well, every week at Monocle we like to go out and meet our neighbours to get to know some of the thriving local businesses that surround Midori House. This week we went to Pearl, a cocktail bar just around the corner from Midori House. Now, drawing on themes from over the past two centuries, Pearl merges American and British drinking cultures in its basement bar on Blandford Street. On the menu is both the unique and the traditional, with a focus on high-quality gin. Monocle went down to speak to the bar manager.
Okay, so I'm James. I am the bar manager of Pearl in London, which is Blandford Street, just off Baker Street. Pearl is a forward-thinking, almost the extent of experimental cocktail bar. Pearl has been here 2 years. We're going to celebrate our birthday in the next couple of weeks, which we'll be putting on a greatest hits for the last 200 years of cocktail drinking. Before that, we started as a consultancy company, working in the Middle East, and we basically we're very successful, so we decided why not open our own bar. We're extremely fortunate to have some amazing team members. Our directors are award-winning bartenders, and we also have the use of a lab at our sister site, the Worship Street Whistling Shop, where we can utilise rotary vaps, vacuum-packed ceiling, and we have a fine selection of chemicals to make forward-thinking drinks. We have one that's been on the menu since the start called, it started its life as the Mr. Hyde's Fixer Upper, but now it's amalgamated into the Mr. Hyde's Number 2, which is probably our best-selling and almost the quintessential Pearl drink. It's a rum-based cocktail that's smokes in a potion bottle with Pedro Jimenez sherry-infused applewood chips. And then it's served on a bath of dry ice that's ignited with a Lapsang tea fog. We cater for everyone. We don't have a dress code. We basically wanted to make a place where everyone feels welcome. I mean, the seating in here is almost like being in a sort of Victorian pub. So it's a very comfortable setting, everyone's welcome. The atmosphere, having just such a great eclectic mix of people, not even people who are really that into cocktails, but they love the theatre. They they want to have something to tell their friends the next day about some drink they had.
Service!
But around this area, there's not that many cocktail spots or drinking dens. We knew that the menu was going to be strong enough, and we had the experience to make the atmosphere good enough that people necessarily don't have to live around here to come. As well as pushing forward our own new techniques, we also celebrate very much the history of drinking and drinking culture. We tried to source glassware that would have been, glassware and ingredients that would have been used sort of 100, 150 years ago, bespoke julep tins, egg cups to serve Sazeracs as they were first intended in New Orleans.
That was bar manager James Stevenson at Pearl in London. That's all we have time for today. The producer was Marcus Hippie. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Up next, it's the news. And then it's this week's episode of The Menu, hosted by Marcus Hippie. Today, The Menu will visit a restaurant in Tunis that reflects the city's Jewish history that's over 2,000 years long.
At first glance, the menu here is an indecipherable list of dishes. But this is just code for delicious helpings of gently spiced stews, succulent chunks of meat and fragrant domes of traditionally prepared couscous.
In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, it's the Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. They'll be discussing human rights in Bahrain. And don't forget, this weekend is the Monocle Country Fair. Midori House will be back at the same time on Monday. I'm Andrew Tuck. Thanks for listening and goodbye.